political competitor.
Back again with us is Atafeh Paddydar and our special guest, Professor Suma Athreya. Professor, India has chosen not to join the RCEP, but regional economic pacts have proven to work in the past, like the EU or NAFTA. Do you think that India may one day actually join an international or regional economic bloc? And what are the advantages and disadvantages?
So the classic economic position on this is that the regional bloc is a form of collective protectionism. And it makes sense to join the regional bloc if your trade creation from joining the bloc is going to be greater than the trade diversion from existing structures of trade. And from this perspective, you have to ask, well, does India already have a lot of trade with the REC countries? And the answer is no, it doesn't have this trade. You could say, okay, it doesn't have this trade, but it might develop this trade over time. And again, here, it's not very clear that that can happen. So India's prominent trading partners are actually the Middle Eastern countries and the US and Europe. Those are very big trading partners. China has become important in recent years. About 10% of imports come from China. But it's not clear that China cannot be substituted by other countries, or that joining the REC will give India a very big advantage on Chinese imports. In any case, as you know, there are other geopolitical concerns, you know, China and India having some border issues at the moment. And the last thing that the government wants is to seen as allowing China to enter and take it over economically.
Well, Atafeh, in our previous episode on economic divide, we did cover the RCEP, many people claiming that the deal actually just benefited China. Do you think that that is the main reason that India chose not to sign this deal, which happened at the last minute, from what we understand, and then preferred to actually continue trade deals with its more traditional partners instead, like the one our guest mentioned?
Well, there's no doubt that China is the main player in the RCEP deal, but it has guaranteed to help its partners, especially during this pandemic. It has the power, resources, and the experience to do so. What prevented India from getting involved in RCEP was not the fact that China was the main player. India didn't want to upset the United States. As we know, China and United States has been engaged in a trade war for the past couple of years, and Narendra Modi wanted to get closer to the United States since he took office. But what he didn't predict was the fact that maybe Donald Trump couldn't get reelected, and we have to see how he's going to manage this crisis, because he lost the RCEP, China, and now he lost the support of Donald Trump.
Sure, indeed. That's going to be trying times for India, it appears, at this point anyways. Okay, many thanks to Atafeh Paddydar and also Professor Suma Athreya for their valuable thoughts and for their contributions to this program. Time now to take a look at our popular news section, 1,000 Words. India, with its large and diverse population, is well on the way to becoming a contender as one of the world's largest economies, particularly as the service sector gathers pace across the country. However, it appears that as technology and the desire for innovation grows, the tendency to forget the more rural areas and poor populations in the country is leaving many people discontent with the way things are going. With farmers protesting across the nation at the new laws being passed, it seems that India is on the tipping point as to where it's going to go next. Does it modernize and advance, or stick with tradition and risk losing out to global and regional competitors like China? I'm sure you will all agree there are some tough choices on the horizon for the Indian government. That's about all the time we have for this episode. I'd like to thank all my guests for joining me on the show. On behalf of myself, Kavit Halfway, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration's first steps have already disappointed housing and racial justice activists who say bold action is urgently needed to keep people in their homes amid a deepening housing crisis, says Mike Ludwig, reporter, in an article published under the heading, Biden has extended eviction moratorium. Now it's time for more. Stay tuned for the details, please. The Biden administration's first steps have already disappointed housing and racial justice activists who say bold action is urgently needed to keep people in their homes amid a deepening housing crisis. Under Biden's direction, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, extended a moratorium on evictions through March 31st. The moratorium may prevent a mass eviction crisis in the infancy of Biden's presidency as Congress debates fair action. But the existing moratorium put in place by the Trump administration has failed to uniformly prevent landlords from pushing low-income families out of their homes during a deadly pandemic. In statements and interviews, tenant organizers and advocates for low-income renters said they are still fighting eviction processings in a number of states despite the CDC moratorium. Families are still being pushed into crowded shelters and onto the streets. Landlords in just five states filed for 4,901 evictions last week, according to Princeton University Eviction Lab, which has counted more than 220,000 evictions since the pandemic began, despite moratoriums enacted by cities and states. Extending the current CDC policy does not actually end evictions, particularly in states with weaker protections like Missouri and Kentucky, said Tara Ravenver, director of the Housing Guarantee Campaign at People's Action, in an email. Biden's decision means that courts around the U.S. will continue to hear evictions and force tenants to the streets while the pandemic rages on. Many Black, Latinx, and indigenous communities faced the housing crisis long before the pandemic began. Structural racism has generated stark racial inequalities in the housing system for centuries, and people of color are overrepresented among the estimated 14 million people who are currently behind on rent as unemployment remains rampant. Evictions and housing inequality are linked to increased spread of COVID-19 and higher rates of infection and health among Black, Latinx, and Indigenous people, according to a study published in November. For weeks, housing and racial justice activists warned the incoming Biden administration that the CDC moratorium is broken, in part because it does not prevent landlords from filing for evictions in local courts. The Trump administration left the moratorium intentionally weak, with no real mechanisms for enforcement, allowing landlords to exploit loopholes and leaving millions of renters unprotected, according to the Right to the City Alliance. As Biden's transition team prepared for Inauguration Day, a coalition of groups released a letter with a list of specific fixes that would strengthen the moratorium, which currently places the burden on tenants to apply for protection under the moratorium in court. In many cases, families staring down a crisis do not know the moratorium exists. The coalition called on Biden to strengthen the moratorium by executive order. Yet the flurry of orders released by the White House since Biden took office does not include any specific on housing and evictions. It would have been easy to improve the failed Trump moratorium, and Biden should have done so, Ravenveer said, choosing not to welcome at the cost of human life. Biden does have some proposals for addressing racial housing disparities over the longer term, and his administration quickly extended the moratorium on evictions and foreclosures of rural homes enrolled in certain federal mortgage programs. The administration will also continue a pause on federal student loan collections, but many activists note the administration could have taken much stronger action toward actually canceling debt. Another executive order asks federal agencies to remove barriers to benefit, such as unemployment benefits and nutrition assistance, a policy no-brainer for Democrats replacing a Republican administration. Biden's first moves are all administrative actions the White House was able to take quickly. By extending the CDC eviction moratorium for only 2 months and without the stronger provisions, Biden signaled that he is leaving the job of protecting renters for the remainder of the pandemic up to Congress. Biden is asking Congress to pass $1.9 trillion rescue stimulus package that would extend the eviction and foreclosure moratorium through September. Along with new unemployment benefits, the package would provide $25 billion in emergency assistance for struggling renters on top of $25 billion Congress approved last month. With millions of people owing an estimated $70 billion in back rent as of last month, advocates for low-income renters say up to $100 billion is needed. While the proposal would funnel another $5 billion through assistance programs that help low-income households pay energy and water bills, it does not include a national moratorium on utility shutoffs, as some had hoped. Utilities make homes livable, but only 17 states currently require utility companies to continue providing service during the pandemic, regardless of a customer's ability to pay. Biden is also asking Congress to fund his administration's sweeping plans for speeding up the delivery of COVID vaccines and streamlining the government's pandemic response. The rescue package includes some long-time progressive priorities, such as raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. However, raising the minimum wage will likely be opposed by conservative lawmakers and millions of people struggling to pay for basics such as food and rent will not magically see their debt to landlords and bill collectors disappear when the pandemic subsides. Housing justice activists have bigger ideas for addressing the housing crisis, which they see as crucial for protecting people from COVID and addressing rampant racial inequality, two of the Biden administration's stated goals. Backed by activist Representative Ilhan Omar has pushed the Rent and Mortgage Cancellation Act, which would cancel rent and mortgage payments for the duration of the pandemic and allow landlords to recoup their losses by applying with a federal relief fund. Some activists prefer rent cancellation to direct rent relief payments because undocumented renters and others may be unable to apply for relief from the government. Housing justice activists are also demanding non-congregate housing for everyone currently living in shelters, jails, prisons, group homes, and nursing homes where social distancing is difficult or impossible. They see emergency pandemic housing as a step towards a homes guarantee that would finally eradicate homelessness by providing public eco-friendly housing. Caldwell and others who have faced eviction have embraced proposals to reinvest in existing public housing and build 12 million new homes to provide a social housing option below market rental rates. Public housing is not new, but activists say the existing system is plagued by austerity and the same systematic racism that causes widespread housing inequality to begin with. Meaningful federal investment in a homes guarantee would spare construction of energy-efficient homes across the U.S., creating badly needed jobs in green construction, according to the Justice Collaborative. We need to transform housing from commodity to public good, Caldwell said. This is not a time for incrementalism. This is a time for systematic overhaul, he said.
It seems that as Britain left the European Union at the end of last year, the inevitable was going to happen to the British economy as a direct consequence of Brexit, with goods, services and business essentially halting their flow between London and the EU, leaving the British economy gasping for air. Add to this the devastating impact of the COVID-19 virus, which has placed the country into its third lockdown, and there's no doubt that Britain is entering a double-dip recession as COVID-19 cases surge across Britain. With the full impact of Brexit yet to be felt until the end of the first quarter of 2021, the end of 2020 saw the British economy sink by some 2.6%, leaving it easy to predict that things will get a lot worse come spring as Britain sinks further into misery. The cases of COVID-19 in the UK has put the country at the top of the global list when it comes to the worst death rate in the world, with daily death rates in the last few days fluttering around the 2,000 mark, meaning the knock-on effect towards the economy is proving to be equally as fatal. All eyes are now on the UK from Brussels and the rest of Europe to study how they're faring since their departure from the bloc, with many keen to show that by leaving the EU, the future does not look bright, and it's hence aimed at discouraging others to emulate a Brexit of their own. Yet Germany, and in particular Deutsche Bank, have looked at the British economy and concluded that three major factors have contributed to the decline, with two of the main reasons coming from the impact of Brexit rather than that of COVID-19, something that the British will not care to admit. So just how big a fall will the second dip be for Britain? Will it be worse than the first one? And just how long will it take the UK to climb out of a very deep, dark and slippery hole that it's found itself in?
Well, GDP will shrink, likely between 5 and 25%. It depends on how long this lockdown will last. And we have now indications it will be another extension and another extension and another extension, as happened throughout 2020, where initially we were told it was going to be 2 weeks. It turned out to be longer than 2 weeks. So we have to expect most of 21 is going to be a lockdown year. And that will, in that case, of course, we have to look at the bigger figures of GDP contraction, 25 to 30%.
Much like Britain, the EU has felt the impact of the COVID-19 virus. But unlike Britain, the EU has a multitude of industries and services that it can rely on to contribute to the economy, to sway things back into the black in times of crisis. Yet it seems that so heavy has the impact of the third wave of the pandemic been on the EU that the financial commitments made by Brussels have not caught up with the Eurozone, which could see as many as 19 EU states fall into a deeper recession as a result. Already signs are looking bleak for the EU, with the zone seeing its Purchasing Managers Index, or PMI, fall to below 50 points to 49.1, indicating a serious downturn in economic activity, sparked by the stringent lockdowns rolling out again across the EU. But the EU has demonstrated the ability to work together to find solutions. The 2008-2009 global crash was a fine example of such camaraderie, but with things taking an impact on a much larger scale this time round, will coming out of another recession prove to be more demanding this time round?
No, I mean, you know, that's not any more difficult. The problem is, why are we shrinking the economy artificially by shutting down everything and prohibiting business activity? Why are we restricting individual freedoms, and why are we particularly annihilating small and medium-sized enterprises, particularly in service sector, catering, all sorts of face-to-face type of businesses? Is this justified? Where's the cost-benefit analysis? There's never been any, and it doesn't make sense. And of course, the longer you do this, the bigger the contraction.
The future ahead now falls in the hands and arms, it seems, of the people of Europe as various vaccines are deployed to try and stop the virus once and for all. Yet the sheer logistical scale of such an operation, coupled with the already crippling effect on the economy caused by the virus, will mean that many more will suffer before things start to return to any notion of normality for Europe. The end of the Cold War came as a huge relief to the people of the world, who felt that the bipolar world order tension had finally ended, and the world could settle down and live in peace. However, it seems that the Western powers still needed a scapegoat to target, and hence the birth of Islamophobia was commenced, and in the process, the Western media created a new enemy. Yet in 2015, following a spate of numerous events around the world, the leader of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, wrote a letter to the youth of the Western world asking them to ignore the media and reconsider the image of Islam. But it seems that the leader's message of 6 years ago is still very much valid today, as his words are well reflected in the ongoing spreading of fear and the spreading of hatred demonstrated by Western leaders towards Islam and Muslims in general. One only has to look at the far-right ideologies of ex-US President Donald Trump, who during his tenure instigated one of the most controversial and discriminatory laws ever passed when he executed his so-called travel ban on countries with a majority Muslim population. Although it was not Trump who started Islamophobia, he certainly added fuel to the fire through his words and actions.
I'm here to protest Donald Trump's racist, xenophobic immigration order, which is against everything that America is about and against everything I stand for as a human.
Yet the leader of the Islamic Revolution raised a very valid point 6 years ago, and is one that stands true more than ever today as technology advances and has encouraged the youth of the world to break down the barriers fabricated across the globe and use the tools and resources so readily available to educate themselves about the truth, hence exposing the lies and deceit created and encouraged by the likes of Donald Trump et al. When it comes to Islam. With some people being led to believe that Islam is the world enemy, so many fail to see the consequences of Western actions, either directly or indirectly against Islam and Muslims, hence proving that back in 2015, the leader knew that the time had come for enlightenment, and as the message stands as strong as ever today, sadly, the youth of the West are still falling to the influence of negative images, catalyzed and sparked by real extremists around the world, whose sole aim is to create division and tension between mankind. When the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo published offensive pictures of the Prophet Muhammad, the Muslim world reacted with anger, stating that the line between freedom of speech and respect for religion and faith had been breached, and saw the resulting attack on the HQ of Charlie Hebdo condemned by the world over, including Muslims, who were horrified by the extremist reaction. Yet the republication of the cartoons, as well as the rise of the far right that stemmed from the events, have seen a huge rise of Islamophobia in France, and is something that's almost been encouraged by French leaders who have failed to condemn the actions taken under the so-called pretext of free speech. Yet it seems that time is not a healer when it comes to such acts, as the rise of Islamophobia begins to gather pace across Europe, in part assisted by the French, exporting their model of Islamophobia across the continent, according to the international head of CAGE, an NGO based in the UK that fights against the discrimination against Muslims. Although the world is currently distracted by events such as the COVID-19 pandemic and various social political events around the world, some have taken a stance against the ongoing phenomenon of Islamophobia, making sure the problem is brought to the attention of the highest authorities. It's hence why some 36 NGOs from across 13 nations around the world have sought intervention by the United Nations to tackle the problem from the top, encouraging world leaders to take a stance against Islamophobia as they would any other form of discrimination or hate. What now remains to be seen is whether a change of president in the US and the lifting of the so-called travel ban will start a new era in the world order and encourage other world leaders and the youth of the West to take a new look at Islam and finally understand that hatred being spread by a small minority should once and forever remain a thing of the past.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump took full advantage of his last hours in office this week to push through a flurry of controversial decisions. One of Trump's final acts was signing a deal to sell state-of-the-art warplanes and drones to the United Arab Emirates. His administration reportedly signed the deal just 1 hour before Trump's tumultuous presidential term was over. Under the agreement, the UAE is expected to receive 50 stealth F-35 warplanes and 18 advanced Reaper drones. The Emiratis have long expressed interest in getting the stealth jets. The UAE was promised a chance to purchase them when it agreed to normalize relations with Israel last August, angering the Palestinians. The arms deal was pushed by the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who is central to the normalization of ties with Israel. The weapons package is considered another part of Trump's notorious dealings with Persian Gulf Arab allies, which have long records of human rights violations. The Emiratis, for instance, have been deeply involved in the devastating Saudi-led war on Yemen, which has triggered the world's worst humanitarian disaster. The UAE has carried out a large number of aerial bombardments in Yemen, where hospitals, schools, weddings, and funerals have been among the targets on the ground. The business-minded former U.S. president boosted weapons transfers to its regional allies despite outcry by human rights advocates. A coalition of human rights organizations recently urged the U.S. to avoid further arms sales to the United Arab Emirates. The rights groups believe more arms for the Emiratis would worsen a set of bloody conflicts in Yemen, Libya, and beyond. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was dismissive of such warnings. The United States itself has been deeply involved in the Yemen war ever since it began in 2015. The U.S. military support for the Saudis and their Emirati allies has included mid-air refueling, providing intelligence and logistics. During his presidential campaign, the new U.S. president signaled a major shift. He has pledged to take a tough line on human rights issues, even when it comes to America's allies. Biden has also hinted at ending weapons transfers and military support to the Saudi-led coalition pounding Yemen. But critics say actions speak louder than words. They say there is no guarantee that Biden will change America's approach as he promised. Saudi and Emirati petrodollars have proved irresistible to many American presidents. Is Joe Biden really willing to put human rights first and change America's stance in the region?
I don't think any American government, any American president is going to step completely away from the petrodollars coming into the American defense industry. However, I think everyone has to realize in Washington and elsewhere is that this war, I hate to keep harping on American national security, but what does it have to do with American national security?
How will he deal with powerful Saudi and Emirati lobbies in Washington? Biden faces tough choices over Yemen and his ties with the regimes of Saudi Arabia and UAE, as he will probably need to make very important decisions soon.
The British military complex is a shadow of its former empirical past, plagued by huge budget deficits, deteriorating equipment, and a very demoralized group of staff. Therefore, in order to bolster the bank balance, the British have leaned on their experience in the service sector and have turned their military into a training facilitator for paying customers. Following a Freedom of Information request by an anti-arms sales group, it's become apparent that the UK military has recently been responsible for training foreign military forces from over 150 countries around the world, equating to some two-thirds of the global countries, and has included tasks from battle training to military band practice. Whereas this could be seen as a sensible way of making money, the reality is that some 15 of the countries who have paid for the training have been rebuked by the British authorities for violations of human rights abuses, raising the question as to just how serious the British are when it comes to human rights and why they would agree to train such countries.
This is a difficult situation, and the opposition parties in Parliament have raised the question. The campaigning organisation at the centre of the current story, the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, has tried through the courts to bring into force a more coherent British ethical foreign policy. But that has not happened so far, and the Ministry of Defence considers that its relationships, particularly with certain Gulf monarchies, is very strong and important for Britain, and therefore it is basically giving them a green card to go ahead with do what they want.
Media spokesman for the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, Andrew Smith, was quoted as saying that the Act raises a very serious question for the British government asking why they are so readily willing to support countries that apply repressive laws and have been accused of torture or have a known history of human rights violations. Yet the British government and military complex downplayed the allegations, stating that such cooperation was merely part of the statecraft designed to improve international diplomatic relations, claiming that all decisions are made on a country-by-country basis. Yet with the UK on its knees financially from the impact of Brexit and the COVID-19 pandemic, it seems that when it comes to income, one can turn a blind eye to certain events, as every little helps when it comes to earning money. When the former British Prime Minister Theresa May travelled to the Persian Gulf to meet the leaders of Bahrain, the sole intention of the visit was to represent and sell British-made weapons to the island, and is something that's emulated today with other such nations in the West Asia region. With Saudi Arabia also a loyal customer of Britain when it comes to the arms trade, it seems that money flowing in from the arms trade to Britain is enough to divert attention away from the repressive regimes that they sell to. In fact, the Saudi-led war on Yemen is a prime example of such oppression, with Saudi bombs killing over 100,000 people in the country, making up nearly half of the 233,000 people who have lost their lives as a direct or indirect result of the war on Yemen. With the supply of arms knowingly being sold to the Saudis to perform such actions, are then the British not an accomplice to the crimes being committed by Riyadh? And if so, should the UK not be sanctioned for their role in the deaths of so many innocent civilians?
Well, certainly there's been concern expressed about British training for sniper forces in Bahrain, given the efforts of Bahrain Defense Force against the Shia majority population in certain situations. And then, of course, British support through the arms trade for the Saudi led coalition's efforts in the war in Yemen since 2015. So this is something which is certainly full of contradictions. And again, the opposition parties in Parliament have raised these questions, would like to see the policies changed. But at the moment, there is no chance of that happening so long as Boris Johnson and his Conservative ministers are in power.
Yet the truth of the matter is that Britain itself is guilty of human rights abuses and has been demonstrated throughout time, with atrocious allegations being made against British soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, and of course a lot closer to home in the treatment of the people of the north of Ireland during the Troubles, which saw British soldiers committing acts that will long remain in the memories of the victims, hence proving that Britain has no moral values when it comes to certain issues.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Certain points about economic problems. The necessity to control high prices.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
The urgent matters are primarily related to curbing high prices. Effort should be made in this regard. Economic experts believe that this is possible. Executive managers in economic areas believe that prices could be controlled and curbed. Of course, when prices sometimes go up, this is because of a shortage of goods and products, but in certain cases, there is no shortcoming. There are goods and products and there are plenty of them, but they keep them in warehouses and do not put them on scale. The organizations in charge, primarily executive organizations, organizations affiliated with the executive branch and also judiciary branch, if it can help, should enter the arena and confront these individuals. So one issue is to stabilize the market. This state of affairs, where goods have a different price every day, is harmful to the country.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Another issue is preserving the value of national currency. If a foreign currency is given a free rein to go up on a daily basis, this is a very bad phenomenon. This is one of the short-term measures, and officials should carry out their duty in this regard. Of course, I know that the central bank is putting in a lot of effort, and by Allah's favor, it will succeed. I have received reports from reliable sources saying that there are security and political reasons rather than economic reasons for this matter. Of course, this does not mean that there are no economic reasons. Rather, it means that the main reasons are related to security and political matters. If this is the case, it should seriously be confronted. There are some individuals who add fuel to the fire.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Thank you.
World with reporters.
Revocation of autonomous status, unprecedented security clampdown, then the COVID pandemic. Last 17 months have been full of darkness and uncertainty in Indian-controlled Kashmir. The months-long lockdown has left the region's economy shattered. According to official statistics, the economy suffered losses of over $5 billion. Tourism industry, which is considered the mainstay of Kashmir's economy, has been one of the worst sufferers. Now, following months of lull, Kashmir's tourist hubs are coming back to life. Winter snow has brought tourists back to the picturesque Himalayan region and raised hope among those associated with the tourism industry. The world-famous ski resort Gulmarg is abuzz with tourists these days.
The losses are humongous. And as far as expectation is concerned, Kashmir tourism is all about hope and expectations. I mean, for the last 20-25 years, entire world knows that we have been running tourism in very, very challenging situations.
Tourism industry, particularly hoteliers in Kashmir, suffered huge losses, first due to scrapping of Article 370 and then due to global pandemic. New Year has brought glamour of hope with tourists returning to Kashmir.
Yeah, this is the first time I'm here. I'm very happy from the core of my heart. I always feel like I'm on the ninth cloud.
The tourism department is organizing various events in a bid to attract more tourists in order to revive the industry. After Winter Games, Gulmarg is now hosting snow sculpting competition. Braving sub-zero temperature, the participants are working with great passion to produce some of the finest works of art. Meanwhile, a 31-member Indian parliamentary delegation is also here to promote tourism. The visiting delegation also met various stakeholders of the region's tourism sector. Situated at an altitude of 2,730 meters above sea level, Gulmarg boasts of one of the highest cable cars in the world. With breathtaking slopes, Gulmarg is one of the finest ski destinations in the world and the heartland of winter sports in India.
Wrapped in a thick carpet of snow, the ski resort of Gulmarg presents a delightful picture these days. It offers best slopes for skiers and attracts sports and adventure lovers from across the world, and also raises hopes for tourism revival in Kashmir. Sidri Safi from Gulmarg Ski Resort, Indian-administered Kashmir.
The 25th edition of Iran's oil, gas, refining and petrochemical exhibition is held in Tehran. Many Iranian companies that are active in oil and gas industry couldn't show their latest products and achievements. Several senior officials from the country's oil industry also attended the opening ceremony of the show. This year, the exhibition was held under the slogan of National Oil, Iranian Goods and Services with a focus on domestic production.
We are a leading provider of infrastructure, technology and construction services in Iran. We specialize in engineering, procurement, and construction of LPG storage tanks. And we have completed several projects in South Pars region and Kharg and Siri Islands.
The three-day exhibition covered a range of oil-related fields, including upstream industries, startups, petrochemicals and related industries, gas industry, pipes and tubes, and refining and distribution.
Our company is an engineering and manufacturing company, active in field of gas turbines, steam turbines, and centrifugal compressors. We typically work on a package of industrial line of a gas turbine and steam turbine and a package of a compressor. We typically do manufacturing and design of components and parts, and also provide services for overhaul and maintenance of these equipments only in oil and gas industries.
We produce facilities for gas stations, including dispensers and underground tanks. All our productions are indigenous, and we export them to several regional countries. We also build mobile dispensers and rapid installed stations.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's oil show is one of the major oil and gas events in the world in terms of the number of participants.
due to the coronavirus pandemic, this year's oil show is not open to the public, and only managers, businessmen, and experts are allowed to visit the exhibition. Human Abadi, Tehran.
The number of people sleeping on the streets at night across the European Union is growing by the day amid the pandemic. Welfare systems are under enormous strain. We have been speaking to one homeless man in Brussels who is finding it difficult to acquire emergency accommodation.
It's very hard in the cold, in the winter. It's very hard to feel good, to find somewhere. It's very difficult.
A debate on the worsening social crisis in the EU resulting from COVID-19 has been held in the European Parliament.
We have a problem here. The slow, sluggish bureaucracy of the European Union is not compatible with emergencies like the one we face today.
Governments in the EU are being urged to submit pandemic recovery plans to the European Commission so that €750 billion in available funding can be released without any further delay.
Millions of people lost already their jobs, and they are mainly the low-skilled, the low-paid workers, the temporary workers, the young on precarious work.
The European Parliament debate was told the EU social crisis could last for many years unless action is taken to save economies.
Thousands of businesses have temporarily or permanently closed. Millions of Europeans have lost their jobs and livelihoods.
Many EU legislators say the 27-country bloc's vaccination programme is being delivered too slowly. To make matters worse, experts in the UK are suggesting the new variant of COVID-19, discovered last year in England, might be more deadly than previously thought. EU officials are concerned new variants of the disease might be resistant to approved vaccines and vaccines awaiting approval. With that comes obvious health concerns, but also incredible economic uncertainty. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A latest report by the National Bureau of Statistics ISTAT has found that large swaths of mostly young and highly educated Italians have continued to move abroad in search of working opportunities. Italy's young workers have been living for decades. However, the report has highlighted that over 300,000 Italians aged 18 to 39 emigrated to neighboring European countries and overseas between 2015 and 2019, up 33% compared to 2014. One in three of them were graduates.
These figures show that young Italians, particularly from the rich north, choose to leave the country because the labor market doesn't offer them any prospects. This is why young people from the depressed Italy south continue to emigrate to northern cities. We are calling on the government to invest more in the youth, in its recovery and resilience plan, the investment project using European Union funds to counter the effect of the pandemic.
Youth unemployment level in Italy stands at about 40%. Furthermore, 3 out of 10 Italians between 18 and 24 years of age are not in employment, education or training, the third highest percentage among OECD countries.
A recent study by the European Commission has found that Italy, along with Poland and Romania, is among the European countries that send the most workers abroad. This brain drain costs Italy an estimated €14 billion every year.
It's an inconceivable waste. Once trained through our school system, our young Italians offer their skills to foreign countries. It's true, our labor market is stagnant, but it must be said that quite often the system does not reward merit.
Successive Italian governments had long tried attracting back talented workers with tax breaks, with no success. However, a counter-exodus of the brain drain seems to be underway since the start of the pandemic. Data from Italy's foreign ministry shows that in 2020, the number of young Italians returning home increased about 20% over the previous year.
Max Civili, Rome.
A London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission made a plea with Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, reminding the illegal grounds on which top cleric Sheikh Zazaki and his wife were being kept in prison. Simultaneously, the Islamic Human Rights Commission has also written to the United Nations asking the international body to exert pressure on Nigeria to do the same. Lawyer to the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, has expressed shock that 7 days after testing positive to COVID-19, Zazaki's wife, Zinat, is yet to be hospitalized. Also in a press conference, the Islamic movement in Nigeria said that keeping Malama Zinat in Kaduna prison without hospitalization has violated the known guidelines and protocols for the prevention of the spread of COVID-19.
The task force for the COVID-19 pandemic, they went around even sharing, distributing contacts that whenever you see somebody affected, you should call them, they will come and immediately evacuate such a person for treatment. But that of Malama Zinat, she's there for 7 days. Till today, she's still in the prison custody.
In December 2015, security forces attacked Zazaki's house and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters and 3 of his biological children. The Islamic movement in Nigeria said it will continue to demand justice for Sheikh Zazaki and his wife.
We call on the masses to join us in calling for justice. We call on the relevant authorities to respect the law of the land and immediately and unconditionally release the corpse, as court has ordered for their immediate release.
Zazaki's son, Muhammad, said up to now, his mother, Zinat, is still in Kaduna prison and is yet to be hospitalized. The Islamic movement in Nigeria and Zazaki's son are both calling on the authorities to ensure that she receives proper medical care and to release Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife with immediate effect. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Travel agents in 13 different countries should get ready for a rush of customers. The United States has finally lifted its shockingly xenophobic and unprecedented travel ban. Iran was one of 6 other Muslim-majority nations which were primarily targeted, which caused ex-President Donald Trump's executive order to become called the Muslim travel ban, informally and infamously. New President Joe Biden ended the ban on his first day in office. The bigotry lasted 4 years, and the damage to American citizens, countless non-Americans, and America's image cannot be overestimated.
The real shame in this is not simply turning our back on, America's tradition of not judging people on the basis of their religion or our constitutional prohibition against that. But what's really, troubling about this is that we have gone through this process where family members have not been able to be together with loved ones.
Husbands and wives have been kept apart for years. Grandparents passed away without seeing their newborn grandchildren. Weddings, graduations, birthdays, funerals, jobs, business deals, educational exchanges. The accumulation of grief and difficulty caused by the Islamophobic ban is appalling. In many ways, the ban backfired, because it emphatically demonstrated the scope and reach of state-sponsored Islamophobia, something which had been routinely denied by the right and the left, not only in the United States, but across the West.
It's really going to require that we go through the hard work of actually implementing policies, not just in travel, but in other ways that fight against Islamophobia, because we know that it has been a feature in our society, certainly for the last 30 years, but even long before that.
The ban led to doctor shortages.